Well, good morning. So some of you may have noticed my father-in-law, Ken Wiebe, was here last week, and we were sitting in the benches before the service, and he's going through the announcements for the coming week, and he says, "Oh, you're preaching next week. Will your sermon have three parts?" And I said, "Well, not really sure, but this morning I can tell you that there are at least three parts. There's a part about pop culture, there's a part about snakes, and there's a part about dark towers. And if you're wondering how it's all going to come together, well, to some degree, so am I." But actually, Dawn kind of got us started here very nicely with her reference to that J.K. Rowling quote. Because we live in an age where American pop culture has permeated the world to a point where there, a single line of dialogue from a famous book or movie or TV show can conjure up an entire world in our minds. Okay, I'm thinking everybody's heard this phrase, "Beam me up, Scotty." Well, you may have different degrees of enthusiasm for the Star Trek series, but I'm sure you all know where it comes from. And for me, that phrase brings to mind the idealistic future visualized by Gene Roddenberry in his Star Trek series. The impetuous Captain Kirk swashbuckling his way across the galaxy, kept in check by the wise counsel and cool head of Mr. Spock. How about this one? "I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse." Well, if you don't remember, that's from the very first Godfather movie. And for me, that evokes the sleek and corrupt world of organized crime in the 1940s, where amoral players seek power through intimidation, and violence is only ever just a heartbeat away. How about this one? "Play it again, Sam." Well, that goes back a bit further. That movie was called Casablanca, and it was made in 1942, which is part of what makes it interesting, because at the time the movie was made, no one really knew what the outcome of the Second World War would be. In fact, the movie was probably made at the lowest point of the war, when the possibility of an Allied victory seemed very bleak. And Bogart's tough guy character encounters his lost love in a bar and calls for the pianist to play what they think of as their song, knowing full well it will reopen the wounds of their parting. Now, if you're a real pop culture nerd, you're probably itching to tell me, "Yeah, but those weren't accurate quotes." And I agree. Two out of the three, those are not the words the actor spoke, but they are the way we remember them. And in a way, it doesn't matter, because these phrases have cultural meaning because they are so universal. When you speak them, practically everyone around you knows what you're referring to. Yeah, I know for some of you, you might be a bit skeptical. "Oh, this is all just Hollywood fantasy. It provides a few hours of distraction or entertainment, but, you know, eventually we need to turn our focus back to the real world." And I grant you that a lot of what we watch on TV or at the movie theater or on YouTube is exactly that: intellectual empty calories. But the best stories achieve more. The best stories speak to our human condition. They put words to the joy and tragedy in our hearts, which we ourselves sometimes can't express. We point to this character, or to that line, or to that scene, and say to someone else, "There, that's what I mean. That's what I experience. That's who I aspire to be." In other words, the best stories achieve the status of myth, the expression of a universal truth, through a narrative that may or may not be literally true. I'm sure all of you know C.S. Lewis, the famous Christian author, who certainly wrote his share of science fiction and fantasy. Lewis had this to say about myth: "The story of Christ is simply a true myth, a myth working on us in the same way as the others, but with this difference, that it really happened, and one must be content to accept it in the same way, remembering that it is God's myth, where the others are men's myths. That is, the pagan stories are God expressing himself through the minds of poets, using such images as God found there, while Christianity is God expressing himself through what we call real things. Well, Bethany already read the focus statement from our worship resources for this fourth Sunday of Lent. I'm going to reread it now. Allowing darkness and negativity to come in between people or in between people and God is sometimes easier than the vulnerability and humility of being exposed to the light. What are the things that we don't want to see that may be standing between you and me? And you know, being the pop culture nerd that I am, what did I think of? I thought of this line, "Luke, come to the dark side," which is, of course, another misquotation. I researched this. James Earl Jones never speaks exactly those words in any of the Star Trek movies or Star Wars movies. But nonetheless, it set my mind going down a certain path. Now, for those of you who might not be up on their Star Wars mythology, here's the Cliff Notes version. Long ago, in a galaxy far, far away, Luke Skywalker is living a drab farm boy existence on a desert planet when, through a series of chance events, he discovers that he is actually the son of a Jedi Knight. The Jedi are a nearly extinct order of galactic good guys who draw their power from the Force, which permeates all things. The Jedi are locked in an existential conflict with the Sith, whose power comes from the dark side of the Force. Luke subsequently finds out that his father, Darth Vader, is a lapsed Jedi who has turned to the dark side and who now wants Luke to join him so that they can rule the galaxy in an unstoppable alliance as father and son. In disappointment and confusion, Luke flees and seeks guidance and training from the legendary Jedi Master Yoda, who speaks these words to him. "Fear is the path to the dark side. Fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering." Yeah, I know, it's just a movie. And yet, don't these words resonate with our experience? We allow darkness to come between each other and between ourselves and God through an insidious process that begins with fear and ends in suffering, our own and others. Now, I have a pretty active imagination. An imagination can be a useful tool for when, say, I'm writing a song. Sometimes a phrase or a word will pop into my head, and I try to imagine, what story could this be part of? Who is the character who's saying this? What emotions are they feeling? What's motivating them? Where is their story taking them? Or, in the course of my work, if I'm trying to help somebody troubleshoot a technical problem, as they describe their situation, I imagine their combination of hardware and software and ask myself, huh, what are all the things that could go wrong with this? But that same imagination, sometimes in the middle of the night when I'm lying awake, can stoke my fear. When I read the news, or even just ponder my life situation, I become aware of all sorts of threats to my security. All that political stuff out there, like militant Islam, or the nuclear threat from North Korea, or the polarization of American society. I imagine all sorts of bad outcomes. Environmental threats like pollution and climate change. Personal worries like, will my work situation remain stable until I'm ready to retire? Will I have enough money in retirement? Will my health or my mental faculties decline at the onset of old age? Have I done enough to assure my children's future? These fears and uncertainties can assume a sort of critical mass in my mind until I am consumed by worry and doubt, often to the exclusion of anything else. The dark side is calling to me. And Yoda warns Luke and us that fear leads to anger. Now, before I go any further, I do want to qualify that not all anger is necessarily negative or destructive. In Ephesians 4, verse 26, the Apostle Paul writes, "Be angry, but do not sin," which suggests that anger can be an effective motivator toward constructive change. An example of this is when the prophet Nathan goes to King David with a report of a wealthy man who, in spite of having great flocks of his own, nonetheless steals the only sheep from a poor man. And King David is incensed by this injustice and demands to know who this rich man is so that he can be appropriately punished, only to have Nathan reveal that this is really an allegory of David's own adultery with Bathsheba. And even though he is a flawed man, David has enough integrity to connect his righteous anger about the fictional situation with his own misbehavior and is determined to repent. But sometimes our anger is just our fear turned outward toward the real or imagined source of our fear. Anger is a visceral emotional call to some sort of action to confront and neutralize the source of that fear. This is particularly powerful if we see ourselves as victims of some injustice. That way, our anger has a focus as well as justification. In the 1930s, Adolf Hitler played on the distress of Germans, experiencing economic depression in the wake of a humiliating military defeat, to turn their fear into anger against the Jewish minority, who had supposedly precipitated the crisis, first through some sort of political betrayal, and then through a selfish manipulation of the economy. In the short term, this tactic energized the German people because it gave them a sense of purpose and hope that they could overcome their dire circumstances. In the end, it led to the suffering and death of tens of millions and the complete ruin of Germany. In our own time, there are factions who invite us to turn our fears and insecurities against the vulnerable elements of society around us as a way to make ourselves feel superior and powerful. But I doubt that Paul would agree that that is righteous and constructive anger. Once destructive anger has taken root in our hearts, it's easy to take the next step, to hate. Author Joseph Burgo, in his book, Love and Hatred, Society and Culture, says, "We can distinguish between anger and hatred in two ways, intensity and duration. Anger might be triggered when a loved one does something that frustrates us. It tends to come and go, though, and doesn't crowd out all our other feelings for that person. We can sometimes voice it in ways that aren't hurtful. Hatred lasts longer, and it's more pervasive. It tends to overwhelm us and obscure everything else that we might feel. It strikes me that hate is kind of a crystallization or institutionalization of anger. One commenter on the internet made the observation that whereas anger is sort of an involuntary reaction to a negative experience, you know, the way you like pull your hand away from a flame without even really thinking about it, hate involves an act of choice. When we choose hate, there's also a choosing up of sides, them and us, and a formalization of those sides. We create elaborate narratives that demonize the ones who are different from us. They are less than human, undeserving of the same grace and mercy we seek from God. They are unredeemable. We can only achieve happiness and security through their utter destruction. We create rituals and structures that sustain and stoke our hatred. In the book 1984, George Orwell writes about a future dystopian society where everyone's work stops at an appointed time every day, so that the entire population can participate in the 2 minutes hate, which involves watching a propaganda broadcast and screaming abuse at the enemies of the state that are depicted there. Given my political inclinations, it's easy for me to see the parallels to this in Donald Trump's election rallies, where he led chants of "lock her up" in reference to his opponent, Hillary Clinton. Yet I was taken aback when a commentator with a different perspective recently pointed out that, in his opinion, the town hall meetings with Senators Marco Rubio and Bill Nelson that CNN aired following the Stoneman Douglas High School shooting seemed like a similar outpouring of hate against the opponents of more restrictive gun legislation. One interesting aspect of entrenched hate is that once we are fully enclosed within the ideological bubble of one side or the other, it becomes increasingly easy to believe in the absolute rightness of our position. We're comfortably surrounded by like-minded people. It becomes difficult to even hear, let alone give credence to, anything that would challenge our thinking. We become immune to the suffering of anyone who is not on our team. Now, that immunity is not for lack of inspiration. We live, for better or worse, at a juncture in history where I can get on the internet and instantly pull up endless reports of wars and famines and refugee crises, all manner of injustices. Social media has hashtags like Black Lives Matter and Me Too and Time's Up to alert us to the pervasive failures of justice in our society. So it's pretty hard to remain ignorant. But there are reasons to look away. Maybe I look away because the problems seem too overwhelming. There is so much need, and my resources can't possibly address all of it. Or I feel ashamed of being complicit in some way in the problem. Or I may even feel antagonism toward the sufferers, believing that they have brought their misery on themselves. Maybe I even feel a sense of satisfaction or schadenfreude that they got what they deserved. So there's the dark tower that I build inside myself, grounded on fear with a capstone of suffering, and so eloquently described in that Hollywood movie. But does that same movie offer a solution? Well, the Star Wars nonology, or whatever you call a sequence of 9 movies, has not yet concluded. But the running theme up to now seems to be, all philosophical niceties aside, that the only way to break this structure down is through a climactic battle of epic redemptive violence. If Luke or Rey can just pull off that one lucky shot that destroys the enemy's super weapon, then the galaxy will be saved, and everyone will live happily ever after. Except in the real world, it's not really the white hats versus the black hats. Russian author Alexander Solzhenitsyn famously wrote, "If only it were all so simple. If only there were evil people somewhere insidiously committing evil deeds, and it were necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them." But the dividing line between good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. And who is willing to destroy a piece of their own heart? The truth is that this dark tower, in some form or other, exists inside each one of us. And the job of demolition is a task that we each personally have to commit to. Which brings us to the snakes. Our scripture passages for this morning form an interesting set of Old Testament and New Testament bookends. In the passage from Numbers, we find the children of Israel most of the way through their 40 years of wandering between their release from slavery in Egypt until their eventual conquest of the Promised Land. And on the way, there have been tests of faith and lapses of faith and mighty acts of God in response. We all know the story of a stubborn Pharaoh who resists Moses' demands for the release of the captive Hebrew people, and 7 devastating plagues follow. And even after allowing the Hebrews to leave, Pharaoh has a last-minute change of heart and charges after them, hoping to trap them against the Red Sea. But God parts the waters to let the Hebrews escape, and Pharaoh and his army are drowned as they try to follow. Later, wandering in the desert, the Hebrews are thirsty, and God instructs Moses to draw water from a rock. They are hungry, and God provides manna and quails. Now they are beset by a plague of poisonous snakes. I have to admit, this part has fascinated me ever since I was a child. My mother had a German language book of Bible stories that was illustrated with these sumptuous paintings done sort of in the style of I think it's the Romantic period, you know, visualized Albert Bierstadt drawings of the Colorado Mountains, that style. And there was this lurid depiction of people being attacked by snakes. And as a way to save the people from the snakes, God tells Moses to create a bronze snake and hold it up. Anyone who takes their eyes off the snakes that are attacking them to fix their gaze on the bronze replica will be saved from their snake bites. But wait, you say. Throughout the Bible, the snake is used as a symbol of evil. Satan is depicted as appearing to Eve in the Garden of Eden in the form of a serpent to tempt her into eating from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And then God curses the serpent and decrees eternal enmity between the serpent and humankind. Oh, and doesn't God kind of have a bad attitude about graven images? God was pretty upset when the children of Israel made that golden calf while Moses was up on the mountain getting the Ten Commandments. And don't those same commandments specifically warn, "You shall not make for yourself an idol, or any likeness of what is in heaven above, or on the earth beneath, or in the water under the earth." So it's kind of jarring when in the New Testament, Jesus says about himself, "As Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up, that whoever believes in him have eternal life." Well, I'm thinking we can't get too hung up on the snake symbolism here. The point in both stories seems to be that in order to be saved, we have to be willing to change our focus from the fearful thing that is right in front of us, the venomous viper right there at our feet, and look up to the promise of redemption that Christ on the cross represents. To shift our focus from the darkness threatening to swallow us up, to look instead at the light of the world. All of this goes against our natural survival instincts. To let down your guard, to take your eye off the threat, is as instinctual as rushing into a burning building or running toward the sound of gunfire. And yet, I think this is exactly the sort of counterintuitive thinking we need to dismantle this dark tower. Well, I don't claim to have a foolproof formula for dismantling the tower. And there may not be a universal formula in any case, because this structure is different for each of us, constructed as it is from our own unique fears and weaknesses or personal experiences and coping mechanisms. But I do have some ideas for myself that I will share with you. Starting at the top, what is the solution for suffering? It's hard for me with my fixer personality to look at all the suffering in the world without sinking into despair. My power to change the realities of war, poverty, hunger, racism, and sexism is so small. And it seems like any positive impact I do make is so temporary and so easily undone. I can give the homeless person on the corner $20 today, but tomorrow they'll be hungry again. What about all the other homeless people on all the other corners in this city and across the world? But maybe money's not the answer, or at least not the whole answer. Maybe I can offer attention and dignity. Pope Francis has said, "Almsgiving, that is charity, is a gesture of love which directs us toward those we meet. It is a gesture of sincere attention to those who come to us and ask for help. We should not identify almsgiving simply with hastily given money, without looking at the person, without stopping to talk, to understand what they really need. I can grant dignity to the beggar by offering a blessing along with my money and by withholding judgment. I can grant dignity to the victim of racism or sexual harassment by listening sincerely to their story without minimizing it or rationalizing it somehow, or without offering simplistic fixes. When I focus my attention on the light of the world instead of the surrounding darkness, I'm able to see that God does not require me to be successful in solving practical problems, because that success would be about me. Rather, God calls me to treat everyone I encounter as the child of God that they are, flawed like me, but worthy of the respect that I myself desire, worthy of getting the benefit of the doubt, worthy of the hope of redemption. If hate is institutionalized anger, then maybe the antidote is compassion. As we endure a near constant wave of mass shootings in schools and workplaces, I find it incomprehensible that organizations like the NRA stridently oppose any sort of restrictions on private gun ownership. Through the lens of my grief and horror, it is so easy to see these individuals as selfish and heartless, characterized by the famous words of Joe the Plumber, "Your dead kids don't trump my constitutional rights." And yet, I recently read a very moving piece by Condoleezza Rice, who described her experience growing up in the shadow of the Ku Klux Klan. She describes how the Klan's night riders would come through their neighborhood at night to terrorize the African-American residents there, and how her father and his friends would surreptitiously fire their weapons into the air to remind their harassers that they were not helpless. Some of you may be familiar with this quote from Henry Wadsworth Longfellow: "If we could read the secret history of our enemies, we should find in each one's life sorrow and suffering enough to disarm all hostility." When I focus my attention on the light of the world instead of the surrounding darkness, I am able to see through the posturing and bravado of the bully, to see the wounded soul underneath. If anger is our instinctive reaction to the fear of loss or injury, then maybe I can reduce it by adjusting my expectations down. Maybe the solution for anger is humility. Although I have flattered myself that I am aware of the plight of others, that I am, in the vernacular, woke, the recent outpouring of stories inspired by the Me Too movement has left me with a much keener understanding of the unspoken privilege I have in this society as a white male. I take for granted that I will always be given the benefit of the doubt, that I will be respected, that my word will be taken at face value, that the authorities will be there to back me up if my well-being is threatened. It's shocking to realize how much this is not the case for women or for people of color. And if you're thinking, wow, you're kind of late to the party, John, well, I confess I can be a slow learner. In comparison to what the disenfranchised in our society suffer, the things that spark my impatience and anger are truly trivial. Someone cut me off in traffic. Someone failed to acknowledge my professional standing. Someone failed to be sufficiently prompt or attentive when I was in a place of business. When I focus my attention on the light of the world instead of the surrounding darkness, God quiets my selfish, angry heart. Well, finally, we come to the root of the problem, the foundation of the tower, my fears. I think we are quite often very open about our anger and our hate, presenting them as a source of strength and pride. Look at how principled I am. See what a rigorous stand I take. See how unyielding I am. How tough. But this posturing is often just the smokescreen for the fears and vulnerabilities I don't want others to see. I don't want to seem weak or irresolute. I don't want to seem incompetent or lacking in agency. But the truth is that I am vulnerable. In one of his Dirty Harry movies, Clint Eastwood says, "A man's got to know his limitations." And indeed, it's only when I acknowledge the limits of how far my own human strength will realistically take me that I can release my white-knuckled grip on life and rely instead on my faith that God is in control and that Jesus Christ has walked this path before me. Does faith magically insulate me from pain or loss? Does it inoculate me against death? No. But faith opens my eyes to the assurance that there is a reality beyond this immediate world where justice and truth do prevail. As it says in Hebrews 11, verse 1, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. When I focus my attention on the light of the world instead of the surrounding darkness, I'm able to see beyond the limits of myself and this world. So, we've broken down the dark tower. What do we have in its place? Where there was fear, we have faith. Where there was anger, we have humility. Where there was hate, we have compassion. Where there was suffering, we have dignity. Not the makings of a Hollywood blockbuster. There are no big explosions. There is no single moment of triumph. But maybe we have quietly set sail in a direction that takes us a bit closer to the kingdom of God.
Thank you, John. As a response, let's take your green Sing the Journey book and turn to number 95. I want to walk as a child of light. We're going to sing the three verses and then we're going to return to sing verse one more time. So 1 through 3 and then repeat verse 1. Would you please stand?